Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the March 2nd, 2013 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Hey, we've got a full hour of information and discussion about our nation's space program in store for you on this chilly Florida afternoon. I hope you'll find it interesting, a little exciting, and perhaps even inspirational to some extent. Ahead on this hour, we'll take a look at plans unveiled this week to send a pair of humans to Mars in just 5 years, reminisce a bit about the space shuttle program, tell you when the next launch from the Cape might be expected, and update you momentarily on where things stand following the launch yesterday of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. And we'll do at least some of that with the help of my in-studio guest today, former NASA Shuttle Launch Director Mike Leinbach, who is now with United Launch Alliance and helping that company prepare for the possibility of launching humans from the Cape. He'll join us in just a few minutes. Plus, we welcome your contributions to the program today. If you have any questions about the space program or would like to offer a comment on something we're talking about, feel free to give us a call. The number is 321-768-1240. Or if you'd prefer to send us a question or comment via email, the address, of course, is spacetalking@aol.com. Okay, let's get into the news of the day by talking first about yesterday's Falcon 9 launch and the problems the Dragon spacecraft had once it arrived in orbit. Excuse me. The most important thing to say right off the bat is congratulations to the SpaceX launch team, which certainly includes NASA's Kennedy Space Center and the Air Force's 45th Space Wing. The Falcon 9 launch was essentially flawless, lifting off from Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station right on time at 10:10 and 13 seconds Friday morning. The on-time liftoff was especially important because the Dragon spacecraft sitting atop the rocket was headed for the International Space Station. So there was what's called an instantaneous launch window. SpaceX had to get the rocket off the ground right on time or wait at least another day. Fortunately, the countdown ran smoothly and the weather cooperated, allowing the booster to get airborne when it was supposed to, something SpaceX is getting better at with each launch. Now, during the nearly 12-minute climb to orbit, everything with the rocket worked as it was supposed to. There was no repeat of the problem that happened during the launch this past October, when one of the 9 first-stage Merlin 1C engines shut down and caused some damage to the Falcon 9, which made it safely to orbit anyway. In fact, about the only thing that wasn't perfect about the Falcon 9 launch yesterday was the presence of a deck of clouds that limited the view of the spectacle for many around Florida's space coast. But the real drama of the day began moments after the Dragon spacecraft arrived in orbit and separated from its Falcon 9 upper stage. The Dragon's wing-like electricity-generating solar arrays were supposed to deploy about a minute after spacecraft separation. But instead of confirming what is normally a routine event, NASA's launch commentator said nothing as NASA TV showed replays of the launch. Now, as the space community took to social media to begin the speculation about what was going wrong, the first real confirmation anyone had about what was actually going on came from SpaceX head honcho Elon Musk, posting an update on Twitter, which was quickly reported by Mission Control's commentator in Houston on NASA TV. Now, we could spend some time here talking about how that story unfolded from there and who said what and when, and debate whether or not NASA and SpaceX have yet finalized their Media Relations Act during the new way of doing business. But that's all inside baseball as far as I'm concerned and not relevant to what's actually happening in space. By the end of the day Friday, when it was all said and done, we had a good idea of what did happen and what the status of the Dragon spacecraft was. Now, to explain all this, first, you should know that the small rocket engines are thrusters that Dragon uses to maneuver in space, including changing its orbit and for re-entering Earth's atmosphere, are installed in four pods around the spacecraft. Each pod has a pair of propellant tanks, one for the fuel and one for the oxidizer. Each of the tanks must be pressurized with an inert gas so the liquids can be fed into the thruster's combustion chamber and burned. Otherwise, the system won't work. Now, normally, the thruster system is activated first, so the Dragon is stable enough to allow the solar wings to deploy. When it was clear that not all of the thruster pods had come online as they were supposed to, the decision was made to not immediately unfold the solar arrays as planned. Now, the immediate concerns at that point was that the Dragon needed the thrusters to raise its orbit, otherwise it would re-enter within a day or so. Also, the thrusters were needed to safely approach the space station. And without the solar panels deployed, the batteries inside Dragon would run out of energy in a few days. Now, for reasons that are not yet clear, and certainly which will be carefully studied before the next Dragon is launched, the problem with the thruster system was that the inert helium gas was unable to pressurize all four of the oxidizer tanks that are in the four pods. Now, it could be that a valve stuck and didn't fully open, or it could be that some of the oxidizer, which is nitrogen tetroxide, froze and blocked a line. But whatever the problem was, the spaceflight control team was able to open the lines, pressurize the tanks, and bring all four thruster pods online late Friday afternoon. Now, shortly thereafter, the Dragon capsule was able to make the first of several changes to its orbit, not only to prevent it from re-entering too soon, but to put it back on course toward a rendezvous with the space station. Now, the original plan called for Dragon to arrive at the outpost at about 6:30 this morning and then be berthed to the station's Harmony node a couple of hours later, but Friday's troubles obviously scrubbed those plans. The word late Friday was that it would be Sunday at the earliest before Dragon could make it to the station. Now, before approving the rendezvous, NASA managers want to make sure that SpaceX has demonstrated that the Dragon is working normally and safely, and the decision on exactly when Dragon will arrive is very likely to be announced later today, or at least as of an hour ago. I hadn't seen anything new posted by SpaceX or NASA, so we'll learn shortly, I'm sure. Once Dragon does arrive at the station and is berthed to the outpost by the crew inside the Canadian using the Canadian robot arm, it will remain attached for about 3 weeks or so, giving the crew plenty of time to unpack its cargo of equipment, supplies, and fresh Florida citrus fruit, if you believe the rumors, and then load the Dragon with a ton of stuff for the return home. By the way, one of the experiments on board the Dragon and headed for the space station right now is a high school science experiment from Minnehaha Academy in Minneapolis, a school that the church where I grew up in Minnesota supported and a lot of my friends attended. So we wish those kids well with their experiment. In any case, after a very busy and dramatic day yesterday, when it was all said and done, today we can report that SpaceX had a successful launch of its Falcon 9 rocket. Its Dragon cargo-carrying spacecraft is safely in orbit and now working well. And we certainly have confidence the rest of the mission will proceed as advertised. Now, we will keep you up to date, of course, on all of this for you. Just keep your radio tuned to WMMB, and we'll let you know what's going on. When we come back after our first break, coming up here in just another minute, we will be talking with former Shuttle Launch Director and current United Launch Alliance Manager Mike Leinbach. He's joining us in the studio today to tell us what's going on with him. And out at the Cape, we'll share a few space shuttle stories and discuss some of the other space news of the day, including that bold announcement by Dennis Tito that he wants to send two humans to Mars for a round-trip flight 501 days starting in just 5 years from now. Sounds crazy. Can he do it? All of that coming up. Don't forget to give us a call, 321-768-1240. Send us an email, spacetalking@AOL.com, if you want to participate. I'm Jim Banky. We'll be back in right a moment. You're listening right now to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everybody. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in our program today. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. We'll see them right here on the screen in the studio. Well, okay, if ever there is a Hall of Fame created for NASA launch directors, right after you cast the busts for Rocco Patron, Paul Donnelly, George Page, and Bob Sieck, you'd have to include one on the first ballot from my next guest, Mike Leinbach. Mike joined NASA in 1984, the same year I began hanging out at the KSC press site as a college journalist. During the years I was with Florida Today and Space.com, we kind of watched each other progress through our careers. Named a shuttle launch director in August of 2000, he led the launch team for just about every mission up until the last one when STS-135 flew in July of 2011. Since then, he has retired from NASA and has joined United Launch Alliance as its director of human spaceflight operations. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about. Mike Leinbach, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's my pleasure to be here. It really, truly is.
Great to have you on board finally. Well, let's let folks get to know you a little bit more about you, as we always do. Tell us a little bit about your background and how did you get from, you know, where you started, what, in Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
To where you are today?
I sure will. And, you know, before we get going, I'd like to encourage the folks out there to call in questions or write them in, because I really like to hear from folks what's on their mind and answer their questions. So if you guys got anything out there, please bring it on.
And any friends of Mike Leinbach who has their chance now to ask the question.
Right, just the friends, not
just
the
friends. That's right. 321-768-1240. So interest in space as a young boy, you wound up here?
Yeah, young boy. Boy, I remember, I'm old enough to remember Alan Shepard's first flight.
Yeah.
May 5th, 1961. And I think that's what really got me started in space and be interested in space and space travel. And my family, we were on a family trip up to Gettysburg National Park from Northern Virginia, where we lived at the time. And my dad pulled off the side of the road in our old 59 Mercury and said, "Kids, we're about to hear history being made here." So he turned on the radio and we listened to Alan Shepard's first flight.
Wow.
Off the side of the road. And you know, I was only 8 years old at the time, but I really believe, Jim, that set a bit, as it were, and inside of me and really started my interest in space and space travel.
So stay home at school to watch the moonwalks and launches and all of that?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And then that to what? You wanted to do engineering? You wanted to be a pilot? I mean, how did you wind up with – I guess you have a structures degree.
I got a master's degree in structural engineering, yeah, but my bachelor's degree is in architecture, and I remember in high school talking to my dad about going for architecture, and he said, "Now, listen, son, that's not the best career in the world. You ought to be an engineer," because, you know, I was always good in math and stuff like that. But I was a stubborn high school kid, you know, and so I went for architecture. And then I couldn't get a decent job in architecture after I graduated, so I went back for my master's degree in engineering. And I remember my dad saying afterwards, he said, "I told you so."
That's right. That's right.
So dad was right.
We had a student from Merritt Island High School, the Da Vinci Academy, and she wants to be a civil engineer. And same kind of thing, what does that have to do with space? But she wants to build bridges on Mars. You know, so as an architect and the structures kind of guy, you know, building launch towers and stuff another planet. But that eventually took you to Kennedy Space Center. How did you wind up in Florida?
Well, I was working for a nuclear power plant design office in Lynchburg, Virginia, Babcock and Wilcox. And again, with my interest in space and space travel, I sent in an application to NASA.
Wow.
Got an interview and came down here with my wife and did a little house hunting trip, and that was in the fall of 84 and been here ever since.
Just like normal people, right?
Well, I mean, gosh, I was just the luckiest guy in the world.
I bet you were.
So I started out in design engineering at NASA and designing launch pad structures, as you say.
Did I read somewhere, I can't remember where, some oral history or something, I don't know where, that you worked on the slide wire?
Yeah, sure did.
The escape baskets and all that? Didn't get to take the ride ever, though, did you?
No, there are only four people that rode that thing. I was going to be number five, but the center director said, "No, come on, Leinbach. You don't need to be doing that."
Don't want to do that.
Yeah.
That's great. So let's talk about, you know, by 2000, I think it was, you became launch director. Talk about what does a launch director do, very generically. What does a launch director do, and how do you get a team ready to go for a big countdown?
Well, the team is what it's all about. We have had the greatest launch team in the world. We'd been together, you know, at the end of the shuttle program. A lot of us had been on the team for well over 20 years together. But the job of the launch director, it's funny. When people ask me that, I always give them my answer is my job was to keep that shuttle on the pad, not let that thing fly until we were absolutely convinced that we were ready to go. And it took 20,000 different parameters to be correct, both on the ground and on the rocket and over in the Houston Space Center. But then it also took a gut feel. Is there anything else out there that says we should keep this rocket and these astronauts on the ground today? And that was my job. My job was that final gut check, make sure everything was ready to go, and I felt good about the launch that day.
I was reading John Young's book not too long ago, and there's a lot toward the end of the book about all the – you know, he was famous for writing all these memos.
Yeah, sure.
This system needed to be repaired, and this thing needed to be fixed and replaced, and it always came back as schedule and money not being there for it. As launch director, were there systems, were there things that you were nervous about or worried about that you wish you could have gone back and fixed now that we're over with the program?
Well, no, not really. I don't think that the shuttle was such a complex vehicle. It was the most complex, most versatile vehicle that the United States, the world had ever built. And so with that versatility comes a lot of complexity. Each system taken one by one really was pretty straightforward. They all operated right on the edge of essentially right on the edge of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the turbo machinery spun at 70,000 revolutions per minute. And so, you know, it was a very, very high tech, operating right on the edge of disaster every time. But the engineering that went into it and the testing and the training that went into all the systems and the teams really pulled it together. So I think it was as good as it could be. Looking back on it, it had that one major design flaw, and that was that it was mounted on the side of the tank, not on the top, and there was no way to escape a launch failure.
You talked about the training, and I've always been particularly impressed with the simulations training. I've had a chance to obviously cover a lot of terminal countdown demonstration tests. I had one occasion. It was the day, I don't know if you remember, it was the day that Vice President Quayle was here.
Yeah, I do.
And he was, you were on the one, and I was stuck over in the other management bubble as a journalist watching that countdown with the headset on. And you saw the insight into the simulation and the practice, and that I think was absolutely essential for you guys to solve some of these last-minute problems. I mean, you had some really cliffhangers there, even right up to the very end of the program.
Well, we did, and you know, we got very, very good at solving problems along through 135 flights. The training team threw different problems at us each time and required us to solve them. That environment, Jim, in that control room, even though it was just training, the astronauts weren't on board the vehicle, we weren't fueled, but the environment in that control room felt just like a launch day.
Yeah, I mean,
you could have sworn that we were really going to fly that thing that day. The feeling you got and how detailed and meticulous and accurate that math model was.
The only thing missing was the smell of the beans cooking, I suppose.
The beans. I never liked the beans.
You never liked them?
No, I always
had one. Cornbread guy maybe or something?
I always had one little spoonful just to tell Norm Carlson I'd had some.
Norm, there you go. You know, the teamwork and the precision, the ability to communicate quickly, precisely, short words, simple meanings, so clear. I wanted to tell you a quick, real quick story. You know, I was in the hospital for the last shuttle mission. I didn't get to go out and see it. Mm-hmm. And I have vague memories of watching it on TV. And what I remember seeing on TV is not at all what was really happening. I was still kind of out of it. But I went back not too long ago and watched the high-definition NASA TV coverage of the last 10 minutes of that launch.
Yeah.
Big screen right in front of me and my monitor at home. And I didn't know, I had no idea that a T-minus 31 seconds you held.
Yep.
You're in LOX drain back. You've got basically virtually no launch window going to the space station. And the quickness and the sharpness of that team. I mean, what an incredible way to end the program for a launch team than to have that kind of a problem and solve it and get off the ground just in moments.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. You know, we trained so much that when that problem occurred on launch day, the problem was with the gaseous oxygen vent hood, the beanie cap.
Right.
It wasn't locked back. We couldn't verify it was locked back. We had good TV coverage of it, so we knew it was back. We knew it was no problem. But the countdown clock held automatically for our procedures. And we worked our way through that thing very quickly. And I remember talking to Chris Ferguson, the commander of the final shuttle mission, afterwards, and he said, gosh, Mike, you know, I knew we could hold the clock under 5 minutes, but I didn't think we really would. But yeah, we sure as hell.
and to get down to 31 seconds is just amazing. I mean, all of us know that if that stops, then I mean, the pucker factor really goes up at that point because everything's pressurized, everything's literally ready to vault off the pad, and then to have a ground system problem come up, and again, so sharply find it, identify it, make the calls, reset the time, the sequencer, and the whole nine yards. I'm not sure you could have done that at STS-1.
Maybe not. Again, we got better with time. The launch team. We got to the point where we could tell by the tone of each other's voice if we had conviction in what we were saying. That team was so tight. We'll never have another launch team like that.
Again,
some of us have been on that team over 20 years, and the trust and confidence that built up over that time. It just gives you confidence that the guys are making the right decision.
I hear other countdowns of other launch teams, and sometimes it doesn't always come out quite the same, and you realize what a special thing you had. Mike, stand by. We're going to pause now for our five-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. Then we'll continue chatting with Mike Linebach and focus more on his work with United Launch Alliance right when we come back again in 5 minutes. I'm Jim Behnke. You are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
And welcome back, everybody, to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments. The phone number, 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Mike Linebach, former shuttle launch director with NASA, now director of human spaceflight operations for United Launch Alliance, is my guest in the studio today. Mike, it's good to have you. We're having doing so far so good, right? We're halfway through.
So far so good,
okay,
yeah.
Good.
Having a good time.
We have on the phone with us, calling in, let me get all the buttons right. Bill has a question about economic support for space. Bill, welcome to Space Talk. What's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon. Mike, my question is very simple. Given that we are thoroughly a bankrupt country with our national debt and unfunded obligations, all this, and given the fact that except for the Florida delegation, a large part of Congress is not, as well as the actions of Bolton and the president before this, my question, and given the fact that we're competing against China and all the unfair advantages they do in taking contracts away from us and that we want to keep our engineers, here's my question. It's real simple. We're finding now that more and more taxes and fees and so on are being put upon business, more contractual requirements, including the financial under Dodd-Frank and all this. Is this, in your opinion, if you have any, is this going to lead to a serious handicap for all the suppliers that have to try to do the business because economically we still have to compete worldwide with these other launch sources to give us a business, including whether it's government or non-government?
So you're talking about is this all this – The general state of the economy and the problem the burden put on the small business suppliers affects the chain for the launchers? Is that kind of what you're asking about?
Yeah. For example, DeLuca of Subway said he couldn't start his business again because of all the new regulations they've been put on in the last years. Darden Foods has cut back people from 40 to 29 hours. And the bottom line is if all these little businesses that provide specialized services and products that go into making the final program,
sure.
if they're all having extra hardships put on us, which the foreign companies, whether in Canada.
Okay, I get it. Okay, Bill, well, let's see if we have any opinions on that. Thanks for the phone call.
Appreciate it very much.
No problem, Bill.
Well, let's see.
Mike, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, throughout the history of the space program, there have been suppliers in every state of the union.
Right.
In the shuttle program, we had well over 1,000 suppliers coming from every state. And the trickle-down effect of all that money was very real. And we were only getting NASA still only gets 0.5% of the national budget. In the heydays of the Apollo program, it was 4%. I would personally like to see the shuttle or the NASA budget double to 1% of the of the gross national product. And if that happened, you would see a lot more small businesses start up and reinvigorate the supply chain. So it has a real direct effect on us, and I'm sorry to see it happening the way it is.
Yeah, and I would add, too, that in terms of the burden of regulations on all businesses and in small business or otherwise, I mean, those are sometimes put there for good reason and oftentimes not. And the fact that they're there just means that more money has to be spent by these businesses to meet these regulations, to do the paperwork, to file the reports. And all of that kind of overhead gets in the way of doing business in general, whether it's space or anything else. And certainly in terms of the space program, you know, there are not a lot of margins on all this commercially anyway. So the more we can the more that kind of stuff that can go away while still maintaining public safety and accountability for your budget, you know, certainly personally, I'd be more in favor of all that kind of stuff.
Okay, I agree.
You agree?
Yeah, sure.
Well, and Mike Lambach, let's talk about the commercial side of things. You left NASA. It was time to go, and you wound up at Director of Human Spaceflight Operations at United Launch Alliance, which is a great title for a great company. But what does it mean?
Well, what it means is I'm an internal consultant to ULA on how NASA did American manned spaceflight, because we want to start launching astronauts on top of our Atlas V rocket, either in the Boeing capsule or the Sierra Nevada Dream Chaser.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole transition that has to happen within ULA to go from mission success to mission safety, and thinking about the astronauts first and mission success second. And what is all the ramifications of all that, and how did we do it in Shuttle? And my job is to explain to the ULA engineers and management what Shuttle did, why we did it the way we did it, and was it good or bad? And if it turns out that it was a good thing in the Shuttle program, then I'd like to consider it for our manned spaceflight program. If it was a bad thing, I want to make sure it does not get into the system.
Sure. So many questions to follow up on that. One of the kind of the big picture ones for me is we always keep talking about the Atlas V as a human-rated rocket. Why not the Delta IV? Why not the same visibility interest in that rocket?
Well, see, right now it's a capacity, it's a throw weight, it's a trajectory kind of thing. We only want to work on one at a time. We're not ruling out man rating the Delta in the future, but right now we only need one for the manifest that NASA has envisioned, and so we're concentrating on the Atlas V and to take it from a rocket that has put up the most critical national payloads for America. National security space and the NASA missions,
mm-hmm.
The Mars mission, the rover that's up there now, we've launched all those. And so to take those very unique, one-of-a-kind missions, payloads, and convert over into a manned spaceflight program is not that much of a stretch.
Well, this gets into the question I'm wrestling with now. It gets into what we call man rating the rocket. I don't know if you're supposed to call it human rating now, but I certainly always call it man rating.
Right.
Make it safe for astronauts to fly. The question is, if it's safe enough to risk, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion satellite that thousands and thousands of lives are going to count on, you know, in the war field, in the combat field, isn't that safe enough for humans? What more do you have to do to a rocket to make it safer for humans than safe enough to get something successfully into orbit?
Yeah, the basic rocket itself is an outstanding machine. It has a success record unequaled in the space launch industry anywhere in the world. We are doing two specific things, though, to the rocket. We're adding a system called the Emergency Detection System,
mm-hmm.
and that will detect launch vehicle failures as they're occurring and send the abort command to the capsule so the astronauts can abort off the top of the rocket.
Okay.
You know, if we had a major leak in one of the systems on board the launcher, that would be a reason to abort. So that's a new system that we're designing and installing on the rocket. The other one is going back to an old dual-engine Centaur, which is our second stage, and that has a safety feature in it that it would eliminate blackout zones if we had to do an abort and a reentry with the astronauts. It lowers the G-forces on a reentry, and therefore it prevents them from blacking out.
The dual engine does that versus a single engine?
Yes.
Without getting into the orbital mechanics and physics of this, why is that intuitively?
It has more thrust capability.
Right.
And therefore you can go at a lower inclination.
Okay.
A lower trajectory.
Okay.
To get to the same point in the sky.
As opposed to just direct ascent,
as opposed
lofted
to straight up. And so if the old single engine, you launch essentially straight up, and if you aborted, you abort straight down.
Right.
A lot of G-forces are going to re-enter.
Okay.
If you go on a more shallow trajectory, the G-forces are low.
Okay, now that makes a lot of sense. And I remember shuttle, the big deal about shuttle, of course, is that T-minus 31 seconds, the onboard computers take over and runs the whole show. And forgive me for my history. I remember the instrument unit on the Saturn V pretty much controlled everything, but there was something in the Apollo capsule that could sense things, and certainly the pilot can twist the handle and fly as well. All that's what's the philosophy there? You mentioned this detection system that would be in the rocket to send a command to the capsule.
Yes.
I assume the pilot would also have a red light that he could flip something and go?
Yeah, the abort system will be active before liftoff. So if we have a major system failure on the ground before we launch, we'll be able to abort off the top of the rocket, and it will be active all the way through ascent, all the way up to orbital insertion. And so the command can either be sent by the launch director pre-launch, or by the pilot of the vehicle, or flight control at a Johnson Space Center during ascent. And so there will be automated abort signals that if the engine is coming apart, for instance, there's no reason to get a man in the loop. So that would send the automated abort, and then the other ones are more like discretionary aborts where the flight director would determine he wants to abort the vehicle.
How realistic is all this at this point in terms of the business plan and the future? Are you ready to start building an elevator out there at the complex to get the guy up into the capsule?
We absolutely are. We're designing the launch pad structure as we speak. It'll go out for construction May of 2014.
Oh, really?
On paper, we'll be able to launch an unmanned mission in August of 2016 and our first manned mission in December of 2016.
And still looking at 41, the interest in Pad A, 39A out of, or 39B out of shuttle yet?
There's interest from some of ours' perspective. Me personally, I would like to see the program separated. If you look at Complex 41, that's where we launch all the national security space missions for the National Reconnaissance Office. Also, the NASA EELV program launches off that complex, and now we're going to put commercial crew on that same launch pad. And so from my perspective as an old ops guy, I would like to split those programs and take at least one of them up to LC-39.
Yeah.
But those discussions are very, very immature, and it has a lot to do with the funding level that NASA gets.
This past week, Dennis Tito announces plans to send two humans round trip to Mars and back.
Yeah.
No specific discussion about a rocket or a capsule yet. ULA at all interested in looking at that?
I haven't talked to him, and he hasn't asked me, but no, I don't know about that. I think that's the good old American spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit and spirit of adventure and frontiersmanship, but I wish him all the luck in the world. But no, we haven't talked.
You think generically a commercial company would be interested in supporting something like that? Is it just a matter of paying the bills, or would you really launch two people if you weren't so sure they'd come back in about 20 seconds?
Well, we provide the launch vehicle. He's going to have to provide the safe spacecraft for entry and for ascent and return.
And take it from there.
Okay. That's his problem.
Mike, stand by. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we will check in with our weekly local launch forecast. We'll wrap up the conversations of the day and pose our five terminal count questions to the one and only Mike Leinbach. We'll do all of that after this final break. Thanks for listening so far. I'm Jim Banky, and you are listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
Hey, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. With a quick reminder, you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week using the usual social media sites. Your first stop, of course, online on the web, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, where you can find links to an archive of past Space Talk shows, text versions of our occasional orbital inclinations. You can also follow us online with Twitter. The handle is Space Talking. And we have a Space Talk page on Facebook that you can like as well. My son Christopher just tried to call me. If you're listening, son, I'm still on the radio. Okay, now it's time to take a look at the local launch forecast. And with the Falcon 9 off the ground, we have a new mission to begin talking about. We certainly won't have long to wait, at least we hope. The next shot from Cape Canaveral, now targeted to fly March 19th. when the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket is set to carry the second of a new generation of missile warning satellites into orbit for the Pentagon. The space-based infrared system satellite will be lofted into geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles, basically straight up, where it will look down on the planet for any signs of heat sources that indicate a missile launch of some kind. The new constellation of satellites is intended to replace the aging Defense Support Program missile warning spacecraft that we've relied on and watched launched here from the Cape, sometimes secretly, sometimes not, for a couple of decades now. Launch processing at Cape Canaveral's Complex 41 proceeding as planned so far, with the stacking of the 401 version of the Atlas rocket is underway. The 401 version of this booster, essentially the stripped-down version that does not include any solid rocket boosters, but still an incredible sight when it gets off the ground. Liftoff time on March 19th, not available quite yet for public discussion, but we will be informed of the launch window when we are within a couple of days of the mission. You can be sure we'll pass along the time to you just as soon as we know it. For more information about these and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, including the upcoming Soyuz launch, three more people heading up to the International Space Station by the end of this month, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keywords space talk, and look for the link to our local launch forecast. Mike Leinbach, former shuttle launch director, director now of human spaceflight operations for the company we just talked about, United Launch Alliance, is in our studio today and talking about all things space. And Mike is director of humans for spaceflight operations, since you don't have humans flying yet. When an Atlas V lifts off, a Delta IV lifts off, and you got the experience you had as a shuttle director, do you keep you hovering over the launch director's shoulder and say, no, don't do it yet?
No, it's not quite like that. It's more one of being in the control room and trying to envision astronauts on top of this rocket, and would we be doing anything different from the launch team perspective,
really?
Either adding positions or different procedures that may be required. The emergency egress system, you mentioned it earlier, we will have an emergency egress system at the pad. It'll be a series of zip lines, not baskets like in the shuttle program, but zip lines to get the crew off the top levels of the structure. So there are going to be additional factors that the launch team management is going to have to consider, given that there will be astronauts on top. And so that's my role, is to try and envision that and bring those systems to bear.
Do you find an Atlas countdown or Delta IV countdown to be, I don't want to say less complicated, but a different environment, a different atmosphere than what you've seen in the shuttle?
No, I really don't, Jim. Rockets all require a professionalism by the launch team, an attention to detail, and that's the same whether it's the shuttle or an Atlas or Ariane Space. Mm-hmm. I went down and saw one of their launches in French Guiana. So there's an attention to detail that's required, and a lot of the rockets really have this very similar systems, and so the feel in the control room is very, very similar to a shuttle launch. It is quiet, professional, and their celebration after we lift off.
Yeah, really. I guess for the human flights, when you do it for the Atlas, the next thing you're gonna have to do is put a thing in the countdown plan, the checklist that says launch director says inspirational quote to flight crew,
and have a little fun up there.
And have a little fun up there. That's right.
That's a correct statement.
Okay, Mike, look, hey, it is now time for Terminal Count. This is our feature at the end of Space Talk, in which we are going to ask you five simple questions to get to know you a little bit better. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers. This is not a contest. So please, at home, no wagering. All right, here we go. Mike Leinbach, coolest rocket?
You know I have to say the shuttle. The shuttle's an American icon. No matter where you were in the world, when you saw that thing launching, it was America doing it.
So 5 years, 10 years from now, you're not going to say a man-rated Atlas rocket?
I'm not there yet.
You're not there yet. We'll get back to you on that one. First launch you saw, remember, you talked about the Alan Shepard launch on radio. What's the first launch you saw, remember? What's the one that stands out?
My wife and I were down here on vacation going over to Disney in 1982, and we came over to the Cape to do the public tour, and I saw a Delta II take off.
Delta II?
And that really got me going as much as Alan Shepard's flight.
I'll bet it did. Was that still the Delta II when all nines came off at the same time?
I believe so,
that
yeah.
That was such a great sight to see that little
just,
flower kind of thing.
It was just beautiful, I had no idea the power and the beauty of a launch, really.
Yeah. Delta II still, to me, are at least certainly in our family, among the most favorite. The most prized space memorabilia that you own?
Well, let's see. The shuttle launch team gave me the hatch covers from the final three missions, the Endeavour, Discovery, and Atlantis hatch covers that were signed by the flight crews, the astronauts, and also the closeout crew, and I have them framed at home.
That's great.
So those are the last three shuttle missions. I have those to look at every day at home.
That's right. Do you have nice prints of the four shuttle tribute posters that hang in the Launch Control Center? Do you have some versions of those?
I do, because that whole concept kind of was my idea, and my secretary and I designed the Challenger and Columbia ones, and then we let the Discovery, Endeavor, and Atlantis team design theirs, and those things just turned out beautiful. I'm very, very proud of them.
I love to have them on the desktop as a display. I still need them sold as big posters at the visitor complex.
There you go.
Got to work with Bill Moore on that one. Okay, best space TV series or movie?
Oh, easy. 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, really?
That one inspired me. I remember Hal. I remember thinking at the time, boy, you know, I think that was late 70s, early 80s when that came out, probably late 70s. Thinking, boy, we're only, you know, 20 years away from this, and boy, we'll be on the moon, living on the moon at the time, and we got to the moon and back, but we're never not living there yet. But that one inspired me, and to think that there could be another being out there, I think, is what really got me thinking.
It was 68, believe it or not.
68?
Can you believe it? Yeah, my family took me to that one. Mom and Dad took me to that one. I remember it was about the only movie they ever wanted to walk out on. It was just too weird and too loud, and little Jimmy just couldn't handle it very well.
Look at you now.
Look at me now. That's right. Well, it's funny because they took me there because, like you, they knew at a young age that I was hooked on it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, simple question, moon, Mars, or beyond?
Yes, and in that order.
In that order. Don't you think that's the way to go?
Of course. It's the next logical step.
That's right.
Our administrator, Mike Griffin, years ago had it exactly right. We need to go back to the moon and establish a base on the moon next.
That's absolutely right. Need to wrap up with you, sir. Mike Leinbach, thank you so much for being on the program with us today and talking about all this great stuff.
My pleasure.
Good luck, Jim. With human raiding the Atlas rocket.
I can't wait to see it.
That's right. Hey, that's all for now. Space Talk is a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technologies, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. I'm Jim Bankey, and we will talk to you again real soon.